we got kind of stuck in a little bit. We were talking about teleseismic tomography. And if you remember, teleseismic tomography is done by putting out a network of stations. And this is quite a big experiment. So you're looking at the network, which is several hundred kilometres across. And we're looking to image down into the mantle. And in practice, you can image approximately down about as far as your network is wide. Okay, so if you want to image the upper mantle, how thick is the upper mantle, somebody? One person in the class, after 3 years of undergraduate study in the Earth Science Club, knows how thick the upper mantle is. Well done. Okay, so if you want to image the whole of the upper mantle, then how wide does your network have to be? 660 kilometres, right. So how wide is, for example, Ireland? Approximately, yeah. So how wide is Poland, Roy?
700 kilometres.
Okay, so if you cover the whole of Poland with seismic stations, you could see down to the bottom of the upper mantle. Now, have we got anybody else here who comes from another country? Somebody like to volunteer. Where do you come from, Hogan?
Brunei.
Where?
Brunei.
Okay, how wide is Brunei?
100 kilometres.
Okay, so you couldn't even, if you cover the whole of Brunei with seismic stations, you could not even image down to the top of the transition zone, which is at what depth, somebody?
410.
I didn't hear that. 410 kilometres, yes, thank you. Okay, so we did this in Iceland. Many other people have done lots of other experiments too, elsewhere. So Iceland is maximum 450 kilometres wide. So we put this network in, and that was really the best we can do. We looked into putting out some ocean bottom seismographs, but this was back in the 90s, and that was quite difficult. There were a number of proposals put in to deploy stations around Iceland at the same time, but those proposals were not funded, so that work has not yet been done. And the criticism of doing an experiment like that is generally that the noise from oceanic microseismic is so strong that you'd have to keep the network in for 10 years in order to register enough large earthquakes to be able to do the analysis you want. However, an experiment of this sort has been done around Hawaii. Does anybody know how wide Hawaii is? The biggest island. Has anyone been to Hawaii? Nobody? Stay-at-homes. The biggest island is 100 kilometres wide. So, of course, people are very interested to know if there's a mantle plume under Hawaii, but it was not possible to answer that question with just a land deployment. So the American NSF invested $6 million in deploying a lot of seismic stations on the ocean floor around Hawaii to broaden the network. But anyway, let's talk about our Iceland tomography. So, you put out the stations, as I said last week, and I think I showed you a map of those covering the whole of the island. And then you have to choose a starting model. So we had a PhD working on this. His name is Matthew Pritchard. He's now working in computing. And he chose this particular starting model. There are a number that you could choose. You could choose PREM or EASP. Quite a lot of different models available. And you might change your choice depending on whether you're imaging a continental or an oceanic area, and you then parameterize your study volume. So this is the way teleseismic tomography experiments are set up. You put your network out, you know, as broad as you can, as dense as you can, and then you take a look and see what kind of teleseisms you're receiving. So you'll be receiving teleseisms from the other side of the world, which pass through the Earth's core, and you might even be receiving ones that are quite close. So in the case of Iceland, we recorded earthquakes that occurred in the Mediterranean belt. We also recorded earthquakes that occurred in the Tonga Trench, which is almost the exact opposite side of the globe. So some of these earthquakes were arriving, coming almost vertically up to our network here. But but others were coming in at a bit of an angle. Earthquakes that were just 20 or 30 or 40 degrees away, they would come in at an angle like this. So Matthew set up a parameterization like this, and the program requires that all the earthquakes that you use have entered the study volume through the bottom. So this is why it's much wider at the bottom than the top, because all the rays have got to come in through here. If a ray comes in through the side, that can't be used because the program is not written to deal with that. Of course, you could adapt the program, but that has not been done. Okay, so the inversion is not like the local earthquake tomography inversion. So if you remember, in the case of that sort of tomography, you read in the earthquakes, and the program first locates the earthquakes, and it holds those locations fixed, and it changes the model to try to reduce the RMS discrepancy between the calculated and the observed arrival times. So it locates the earthquakes, changes the model, holds the model fixed, relocates the earthquakes, holds those earthquakes fixed, changes the model again, and it keeps doing this several times. So it might do this four or five times. And it's quite a long process, because every time it locates a single earthquake, it's got to do several iterations of that to get the earthquake location. You might have, say, 500 earthquakes. It's got to iterate many times to locate each earthquake, and it's got to invert for the model, and it's got to redo it. And you could have typical runs which might take 12 hours or 24 hours or 36 hours. It can take a long time to get those results. But this program just runs like a shot, because it doesn't have to iterate. It assumes that it knows essentially where the earthquakes are, so it doesn't have to solve for those. So it can just calculate the structure of the volume of interest just by damped least squares in one step. So then when you've got your answer, everybody wants to know what the errors are. Okay, and that's not a very straightforward thing. So you can calculate all sorts of different errors. But part of the focus on the meeting that I've just been to, where this ridiculous incident occurred in the middle of my talk, I was actually criticising this tomography method quite heavily. And of course, there were lots of other seismologists in the room who had got their talks all prepared, and they were going to show lots of colour cross-sections, and they were not going to talk about errors at all. All you see is a colour cross-section, and you get an interpretation. So not everybody liked what I said. Used to that. You haven't heard me talk about religion yet. Okay, so there are a number of different ways of going about this, and these are all fairly inadequate, but let's take a look at them anyway. So first of all, you know, there's a very, very basic one, and that is, how much data have you got? So let's take a look at the hit count. So here we have the parameterized volume, the rays coming in through the bottom, and the place where you can image the structure the best is where the rays cross over. So you can see that this part of the volume is labelled good. There's good resolution, fair resolution here, and poor resolution out to the sides here. And the reason the resolution is poor out to the sides is because all the rays are coming in parallel like this. There might be quite a lot of earthquakes. They're coming in more or less in the same direction like this. And you don't have any crossing rays. So the point is, if these rays were delayed, supposing they turn up at your network a little bit late, you say, okay, there must be some low velocity material there that these rays have been through to turn up late. Well, where is that? Is it here, or here, or here, or here, or here? If all the rays are parallel and none of them are cross-cutting, you cannot tell where along the ray bundle that delay occurred. And if you have, looking at this volume here, for example, then if you see rays coming up from all directions which are crossing in this volume, and they're all arriving late, say, you're pretty safe at saying, well, they've all seen some low velocity material, so it must be somewhere here where all these rays have passed. So you can see the critical thing is crossing rays. However, we have a number of different ways of assessing, you know, how much data you've got, what the data spread are, and what the geometry of these rays are. And as I say, the first thing to look at is, how many rays have you got? This is the hit count. And Matthew took a look at this for the Iceland array. So here we have Iceland up here, with all the stations. And he did lots and lots of cross sections, which are these things here. But these are depth slices, so I think this is 100 kilometres, 200, 3, 4, 5, 6, something like that. And you can see that he's got quite a dense mass of rays in shallow depth here. It gets a bit less down at this third depth. And then when you get down to the deeper depths, well, you've got some rays out here, because of course they're coming in from the side. But he hasn't actually got any under Iceland at all at 600 kilometres depth. So this is about what you'd expect. You know, there's some resolution, or there's some density of rays in the top 400 kilometres. If you remember, I said Iceland was 450 kilometres across. Once you get below that, you find you're essentially down in this area here. And in this particular case, he didn't have any rays at all. And again, you can see in these cross sections just a reflection of this kind of tent-like picture here, where it's all dense here and it's very sparse out here. He's got lots and lots of rays, all of them crossing out here, but down here in these wings, he didn't have very many at all. And he used to refer to this as the pair of trousers plot. Whatever helps you to remember. What he was saying was that, you know, you've got these rays coming out here, and there's sort of a gap there, just where you want to have the best resolution. So that's the hit count. And then there's resolution. So the hit count is just a raw count of how many rays you've got. Okay, you could have 1,000 rays all travelling parallel, and that would be completely useless to you for the reason I've just described. So the hit count doesn't tell you everything you need to know. What you need to know also is geometry. How strongly is the model constrained? So resolution is defined here, m equals rm, where m is the true Earth model, m is the inversion result, and R is the resolution matrix. So the resolution matrix is something which links your inversion result to what you think the true result is. So it describes the uncertainty in the model as a function of data uncertainty and geometry. It's described in detail in this paper here, which I encourage you to take a look at if you're interested. It's quite an interesting subject. I had a long discussion with somebody at the meeting about resolution. Go on about that. But the data uncertainty is estimated from the data variance after inversion. So you start off with your starting model, okay, your rays are passing through it, and the rays are not turning up, the rays are not registering on the seismic station exactly when you expect them to. You've got some sort of forward prediction of when you expect them to arrive. They don't arrive at that time. Some of them are delayed, and others are kind of earlier than you might predict. And what the program is doing, of course, is changing the crustal structure, changing the mantle structure, so it can reduce the RMS discrepancy between the theoretical arrival time and the actual arrival time. Okay? And what's left over? You've always got an RMS left over, and the square of that is the data variance. So the data uncertainty is expressed, the uncertainty in the data is expressed by the data variance. However, that's not, you know, for geometric reasons, giving you a really good idea of what your true model is. If all your rays were parallel, you could probably calculate some model which fit the data perfectly, so your data variance was zero, but your model would be complete fantasy. You know, there might be an infinite number of models that could do that, and you wouldn't know which was the correct one. So you have to bring in some geometric considerations, and this is what resolution contains. So you end up with a resolution matrix, and the diagonal elements of these give a measure of the resolution of each block in your model. So resolution was also calculated, and we get something which looks kind of creepily like a hit count. It's quite dense in the upper layers, and it becomes worse as you go further down. And then you get this pair of trousers picture again here, which essentially confirms that your model is best imaged in this triangle in the top here. And then you've got these wings out here, which are less well imaged. So there's also something called volumetrics. and this was developed as yet a third way of testing the integrity of your result. And what this is essentially calculating is if you have an anomaly in one block, and then you have a real data set and you invert to see if you can calculate that wave speed anomaly in that block, how much does it get smeared out? So you could start off with anomalies such as this. So Matthew set up these theoretical anomalies. So he's chosen five little blocks here in different parts of the model. And he said, supposing there's an anomaly just in one block. So if I then take the rays that I measured and then I invert for the structure, is it going to tell me there's an anomaly in one block, or is it going to distort that in some way? And this diagram shows the distortion that he found the program was inherent to. So the middle block here, this would be kind of smeared up down. So you'd start off with something that was, say, 50 kilometers thick. And by the time you'd inverted your data, you'd have something that was 150 kilometers thick. So you can immediately see that this method, which is very widely used, there's lots and lots and lots of results out there in the literature using this method. You can see that this method is inherently going to give you an error in the direction that you're most interested in. Because whatever our body, if we're looking for downgoing slabs or if we're looking for upgoing diapirs, anything like that, fault subduction zones, we're quite interested in what the up-down continuity is. But the error in our result is in the up-down direction preferentially. So the error is kind of corrupting the thing that's most important to you in many cases. So for the other blocks, the ones that are out to the side there, Matt found that the smearing was actually stronger than it is in the middle. So the resolution is best in the middle of the model. It's somewhat less good out to the flanks, as we saw in that kind of tent-shaped diagram. And he found that this was indeed the case. The errors were greater out to the flanks, and the smearing was kind of parallel to the direction of incoming rays, so it's flaring out. And then you can do something which is done quite a lot, because I think seismologists are getting a bit tired of all these fancy numbers and calculating resolution and volume metrics and things like this. And at the end of the day, they'll publish papers saying that their result is very well resolved and we can be very confident of it. And then 5 minutes later, some other group will publish another model saying that their model is extremely well resolved as well. And there's almost no repeatability between the two models. So people are beginning to suspect that this is a little bit of a can of worms. And the one thing people like to do is to put in a theoretical model. So they'll take some sort of theoretical model that they're interested in. They'll set this up and they'll say, okay, what earthquakes have we measured in our experiment? Okay, we've measured some at Tonga, we've measured some in the Mediterranean, etc., etc. They'll take those earthquakes and they'll simulate a data set. So they'll make a synthetic data set by shooting rays through their theoretical model and calculating a theoretical bunch of arrival times for those earthquakes. So they've taken a realistic bunch of earthquakes and their theoretical model, they've simulated a data set, and then they take that data set and they invert it to see what result they get. Okay, so we've done this as well, and is very commonly done. So what we did here was to simulate a mantle plume under the centre of Iceland here, all the way down to 600 kilometres, simulated the data, inverted the data, and then we looked to see what we would retrieve. So this is what we would have retrieved. And this is for P and this is for S. So as you can see, we would expect, if such a structure existed, to retrieve it quite well down to 400 kilometres. It would start to, you know, it's still visible, but it's maybe just got half its strength at 500, and then it's pretty much gone. Let me see, this is 520 to 640 kilometres. So once you get below about 500 kilometres, then things are not looking too good. So this is the result that Matt got from this experiment. This is the shallowest depth. This is the 200 kilometres, and once we got down below about 200 kilometres, things stopped kind of looking quite so cylindrical. And let me see now, I think these might be, hang on, these are 50 kilometre slices, so this is 300 kilometres, 250, 300, and then it goes down to 600 here, so that'll be sort of 50, 100, 150, 200, 250, 300, 350, 400, 450, 500, 550, 600. So we were quite chuffed to see this kind of roundish looking anomaly in the shallower layers, but then when we got down to the deeper layers, we started seeing it elongated like this. So you can see that this is, you can see the red clearly obviously, but the yellow extends to the north and the south, and the deeper down you got, the more elongated it was. Okay, so it didn't look quite as we expected, and we produced this three-dimensional picture of what it looks like. If you look down the Mid-Atlantic Ridge from north to south, then you see something that looks quite cylindrical. But if you look at it off to the side, then you see that it kind of widens with depth. So what we were seeing was something that was quite round in the top couple of hundred kilometres. And then when you went down, it got a bit narrower and it became elongated in the direction of the Mid-Ocean Ridge. So we concluded from this that the anomaly under Iceland stopped in the transition zone, because geodynamic modelling predicts that when you approach the base of a thermal upwelling, then it becomes elongated and turns into a sort of blade-like structure. So we concluded that this anomaly did not continue on any deeper. And this was later improved by an improved type of tomography. We did this in the early 2000s. And in the mid-2000s, a new parameterization came along, which took into account the fact that you can't assume rays are infinitesimally thin. I'll talk about this in a few slides. It's been nicknamed banana donut tomography. And somebody developed a program for this, and they applied it to our data a few years after we had finished with the data. And they claimed to be able to extend the resolution down a couple of hundred kilometers more. So whereas our resolution went down to about here, just below 410, this group claimed that they could resolve down to about 700 kilometers, so they were seeing through the base of the transition zone. And they concluded that indeed the anomaly did stop at the base of the transition zone. So this is not due to deteriorating resolution, it's actually a real feature that this thing is truncated. So this is an interesting finding, and simultaneously somebody published a paper, Jeroen Ritsema published a paper where he had just produced a very elaborate, very sophisticated hole mantle tomography model, and this was published in Science just about 2 months after we got our result. And so the hole mantle tomography also confirmed that the anomaly truncated at the base of the transition zone there. So this brings us into hole mantle tomography. So hole mantle tomography is a different sort of cup of tea. You're not looking at just a Cartesian block, you're looking at the whole Earth. We assume that the outer core and the inner core are fairly homogeneous, so you ignore those. So you have to parameterize a volume which is not a cube, you can't just use Cartesian coordinates. It is a kind of hollow sphere. So you have to use spherical coordinates, and you can't divide it just into simple blocks. Also, when you're doing inversions for the structure of the whole mantle, you're typically using waves like teleseismic P and double P, a lot of surface waves, a lot of very long period waves. And typically, you can only resolve structures which are very wide. So the limit of your resolution might be 1,000 kilometers. Some people are claiming they can get down to a few hundred kilometres now. Nobody believes this, at least not the whole Earth. It's very variable, and this is one of the problems with tomography, that you see a nice big slice like this, and you think, oh, cool, we can see everything that's going on here. But a lot of this region has no rays in it. So you may think, oh, well, there's no anomaly in some of these regions here, but the fact is there's no data in some of those regions, so the program has not changed the model from the starting value. So actually displaying these diagrams is a big problem in itself. Okay, so moving on to Fresnel zones and banana donut tomography. when you're dealing with a very long wavelength rays, long wavelength silent waves, which are used for whole mantle tomography, then you cannot assume that this is just travelled in a pencil thin ray, because the wavelength may be several kilometres long. So these seismic waves are sensing a volume which is in the order of several hundred kilometres, and you really need to account for that. So this was recently developed about 10 years ago. This kind of broke out into the community, and people have adopted it with great enthusiasm ever since. And essentially, if you've got an earthquake in one place and a receiver in another, then the ray, you know, if you calculate the ray from ray theory, then it will travel along this yellow stripe here. However, it turns out it's a kind of mathematical quirk which took many people by surprise, that the wave that you record at the other end, if you invert this for structure, its sensitivity to structure is zero along the actual ray, but instead it's at its maximum where, you know, these red bands are. So the zone of sensitivity for that ray is like a hollow banana. So that's why it's called banana donut tomography, because it's got something that looks like a banana here, but it's hollow because the sensitivity is zero in the middle. So here's a little picture looking along this ray. So people adapted their codes when this theory was developed. The person who developed this theory very sadly died of an aggressive form of cancer just a few months after this, you know, made it world famous, so that was very sad. But people have adopted it, and this is now part of many different computer programs. If you decide to take up a PhD in this field, which is very interesting, very exciting at the moment, then you won't be starting writing your own computer programs from scratch. You'll be given a computer program which might be, you know, represent 100 years of seismology computer programming. So you'll get this incredibly complex piece of code that there's probably no one person alive that really understands every single part of it. And you'll be expected to make some small increment to that program. That's the state of things at the moment. So this banana donut tomography was applied with a rather interesting effect to a case in Hawaii. So people are, as I've said before, they're very interested in the structure underneath Hawaii. Is there a mantle plume there or not? What's going on? And in 1973, there was a fairly largish earthquake in Hawaii, which was very convenient. Hawaii is extremely difficult to study using tomography because, you know, Hawaii is in the middle of the Pacific. All the earthquakes are in the circum-Pacific belt. So waves from these earthquakes go down into the earth and they come up to stations in Hawaii like this. So all the rays approach Hawaii in a sort of skirt-like fashion or a tent-like fashion. So lots and lots of rays coming in all these directions here, and there's no rays underneath. So the very place you want to look at where a plume might be, there aren't any rays there, so it's a big problem. But anyway, this earthquake occurred. From memory, it was magnitude 7, or no, it wasn't 7, so it was 5 point something. I mean, 5.7, that's closer to it. So it wasn't huge, because Hawaii doesn't generate huge earthquakes. But it was big enough to generate some core bounces. So it generated waves which travelled vertically downwards, bounced off the core, came back up again, were recorded, and then they went down again and up again, so it recorded multiple so-called SCS bounces. And this is a picture of them. So people thought, oh, this is great, we can use these waves to look at the wave speed directly underneath Hawaii. Is it fast, is it slow? What people did was to actually look at the difference between the first bounce and the second bounce, or between the second bounce and the third bounce, because that would actually tell them the information they wanted. So the initial result from this was that the wave speed under Hawaii was fast. And this was pounced upon by a couple of plume skeptic individuals who said, there you are, the wave speed's fast under Hawaii, there's no plume there. Okay? But another individual decided that it might be fun to apply banana donut theory to this and see, you know, just what volume are we imaging with these rays. So, sometimes the truth is inconvenient. So here we have a little diagram here, and let's see here now. The earthquake was here, and the station that recorded it was there. So the waves went down from that earthquake, boink, down to the core, and came back up again here. Let's see now. So these red rings here show you the volume that the first bounce was sensitive to at 200 kilometres. So that's 200 kilometres, 500 kilometres, 1,000 kilometres, 1,500, 2,000, core mantle boundary. So the very first bounce, SCS, was sensitive to these areas here. But as I mentioned, what was looked at was the difference between the first and the second bounce. So the next diagram shows you the banana donut sensitivity kernels for the second bounce. Okay, this is SCS2. And if you take the difference between them, then you get SCS2 minus SCS1, if you like. And this is what you see. Well, there's virtually no sensitivity at 200 kilometres depth, virtually none at 500 kilometres depth, so this measurement is extremely insensitive to structure there. You can just begin to see it coming in at some slight sensitivity at 1,000 kilometres, 1,500, 2,000, and here we are down at the core mantle boundary. So the upshot of this was that these data that had initially been measured and had been used to say, well, the mantle is fast under Hawaii, there isn't a plume there, in fact, was not really sensitive to anything under Hawaii where you might be interested. Okay, it's just sensitive to this extremely broad region here. And if you had a narrow plume that was maybe twice the diameter of the island, located here, say, then you absolutely would not see it. So the individual who calculated these results published this and brought it to the attention of the other individual who was running around saying that the mantle under Hawaii is fast, only to find that the aforementioned individual continued running around and for the next 10 years kept saying the mantle under Hawaii is fast and just completely ignored this result, which was inconvenient for his story. So let this be a lesson to you all to not do this, because somebody will find you out eventually. Okay, here is Mr. Ritzema's model again. We're looking at a few extra cross sections here. This was a huge work that consumed several years of his life. He accumulated over 2 million data, and he used just about every phase he possibly could. And this involved just an awful lot of work mining data data which are online. I mean, if you want to do a seismology project, there are lots and lots and lots of data there on data banks, just completely free for everybody to download. You don't have to get out a shovel and get your hands dirty nowadays to do seismology. You just have to be a computer whiz. He also used surface waves, so he incorporated Rayleigh and Love waves into this inversion, and that was quite innovative because prior to that people had either used body waves or surface waves, but not both together. And this enabled him to produce a whole mantle tomography model that was quite sensitive in the transition zone region, which is this zone in between the lower mantle and the upper mantle. So this is surface wave tomography, on the other hand. So you can see that there's quite a lot going on here at shallow depth. Interestingly, this anomaly under Iceland in the surface wave tomography is just at about 200 kilometres thick. In the case of this other study, it's more like 600 kilometres thick. That seems to be what we're looking at. The surface waves are mostly sensitive to the surface, obviously, and their sensitivity drops off with depth. So it's pretty amazing that anything is observed deeper down anyway, and this may just all be noise and not have any significance at all. This is my suspicion. But then this was published on another occasion, 1999. So Matthew came to me and he said, what's going on here? You know, we've got a whole mantle plume here, going from the surface right down to the core mantle boundary, and this doesn't agree with this. It doesn't agree with this. So how is it that somebody else has got this core mantle plume? Well, the answer to this lies in these two numbers here, plus or minus 0.5, and this diagram is saturated at plus or minus 0.5, so very weak anomalies down here in the lower mantle. We pop back to Jeroen's model. So here you can see there are very weak anomalies here in the lower mantle. Here's some red ones here. Well, if you this diagram is produced with a colour scale that ranges from about plus 2 to minus 2. So anything that's less than about 1 is not going to be bright red, it's going to be a pale orange. So you can see that there are slow anomalies down here. And if you racked the colour scale up so that these anomalies here in the lower mantle were bright red, well, obviously this one would be bright red too, because that would be at the saturation level in the colour scale. You could make it look as though the lower mantle anomalies are as strong as the upper mantle anomalies, and that's what's been done in this model here. I complained about this at the time, and somebody listened to my piteous cries, and they said, well, you know, we'll just produce a little diagram here that you can use. And what they did was, as I said before, they set up a theoretical body. So what they've done is to set up a low-velocity body underneath Iceland here, which goes from the surface down to about 2,000 kilometres depth. And they then took the data set that these guys had used, and they calculated what the arrival time of these earthquakes would have been if they had gone through this structure here. And then they took that synthetic data set and they inverted it, the structure, and this is what they've got. In other words, if there was a body down here, you wouldn't see it, because no rays go through it. And what this means is that this is basically noise. And if you threw in a few earthquakes, or you threw out a few earthquakes, or you slightly changed the parameterization, then you would change this as well, because it's unstable. It's just noise in the result. And here's a picture where it's been replotted. And so this has got a colour scale of minus 0.5 to plus 0.5, and this has a colour scale of labeled, this is something like minus 2 to plus 2. So you can see again that the upper mantle anomaly is extremely strong. It's much stronger than this very weak thing in the lower mantle, and there are other weak things off at the flanks, like this here and this here, which these guys have actually chopped off, because they're going to show this part of it. So if you run a seismic tomography experiment, it's a big flop, you don't see any structure at all, it's no problem. You just need to fiddle about with the colour scale, chop the section off a little bit, and do a few other things, and you can produce an anomaly as you wish. There's another example of the effect of colour scales. These two are the same model, it's the same result. Probably different colour scales. And what we're really driving at here, okay, when we're not stabbing our colleagues in the back, saying their papers have been withdrawn when in fact they haven't, what we're really wanting to get at, preferably, is to come up with some sort of region, some sort of answer as to whether the whole mantle is convecting as one or layered mantle. That is the objective at the end of the day. Here we have the upper mantle, the transition zone, the lower mantle. So is all of this convecting, so that the lower mantle is connected with the surface and the upper mantle? Or have we got vigorous convection in the upper mantle associated with plate tectonics, and much more sluggish convection in the lower mantle, which may be either unconnected, not have very much direct effect on the upper mantle, or only a slight one? We know that the physical properties change from the surface down to the lower mantle. You know, the thermal buoyancy is much less deep down in the lower mantle, where the pressures are high, and other parameters are different too. The density is obviously much higher, the viscosity is much higher, and the question is, how does this kind of play out, you know, as regards the surface? Is the lower mantle really? Some people would say the lower mantle was more or less completely isolated and not connected. Other people would say that there is some mass transfer, but not very much. And other people would say, well, you know, the transition zone essentially is not a barrier to convection. Everything is going on through. So there's this huge wide of range of opinion. And of course, from the point of view of seismology, we're interested in knowing what can seismology say about this. So here we have one end member whole mantle convection model. Obviously, I've taken this from somebody's published paper. And at one end of the spectrum, people would suggest that subduction zones go all the way down to the core mantle boundary here, and that material rises up from the core mantle boundary in the mantle plumes, and it's delivered back up to the surface. And then you have this other end member model, where people say, no, the lower mantle is basically isolated, it's not having, you know, any maybe very slight effect on the mantle at 1,000 kilometres or what have you, and everything that we see on the surface is the result of the extraction of melt from fairly shallow depths, just convection in the upper mantle, and that subduction zones go down and they flatten in the transition zone and they don't go down into the lower mantle. So these are the two end member theories. Here are some whole mantle tomography cross sections, and they have shown this in the other module, I can't remember. So we're looking at 100 kilometres, 300 kilometres, and here we pop below the transition zone into the lower mantle, and you can see that there is quite a big difference. So as soon as you know, the pattern of anomalies looks fairly much like this all the way through the upper mantle, but as soon as you go down below the transition zone, you lose this kind of pattern, and the anomalies are very muted, the range and amplitude is much less, and the pattern breaks down. So instead of having a big blob of slow here, you've just got everything all over the place. It doesn't look the same. But as you go down and you approach the core mantle boundary, then some people have pointed out that this surface pattern starts to re-emerge. So here we've got high velocities where the continents are, low velocity in the ocean here, and this resembles to some extent this. In fact, I've been staring at this quite carefully recently, because you know sometimes you can say, well, it looks the same, doesn't it? And then if you look at it very carefully, you know, you think to yourself, well, what is the correlation exactly? A little subgroup that I'm working with at the moment is carefully looking at correlations between things. So every so often somebody says, well, you know, the hotspots correlate with the superplumes or something like that. And this group has, we're liaising with a student group in the mathematics department, and they're calculating the real correlations just to, you know, check that these off-the-cuff assertions are right or wrong. So it would be rather fun to take a look at this and say, well, just how strong is this correlation? But if you look at it quite carefully, Africa is fast here, but it's not fast there. So this red blob here, this seems to coincide with that, but if you look at it carefully, you know, it's not exactly correlating. So, you know, this part of the red blob here is actually over here where it's blue. Okay, it's a bit redder there. So it would be good fun to set up a mathematical model and calculate exactly how strong this correlation is. Would you wake up that student, please? If you can't stay awake, then you should not be in class. So I think this is the penultimate slide. That's the good news for you. And here we're looking at 550 kilometres, 650, and the base of the transition zone is 660, so we just pop 40 kilometres down here, and you can see just going from, you know, from through a depth range of 40 kilometres, you suddenly get this radical change. So, you know, there's kind of evidence for and against. It's very difficult to pin this down. I mean, the range of opinion would not be out there if all the evidence was on one side. We've still got a way to go if we want to resolve it. Okay, here we have a Here we have a flattening slab in the transition zone. So many of my colleagues will liberally sprinkle their PowerPoint presentations with pictures like this, and other colleagues will liberally sprinkle their PowerPoint presentations with things like this, where you see some sort of image where you've got blue going from the surface all the way down to the core mantle boundary. Okay, super plumes, I think I've just left a few slides in about those. So these red blobs, which seem to be near the core mantle boundary in the deep lower mantle, very strong wave speed anomalies, they've been nicknamed the super plumes. The seismologist who coined this term had a talk immediately preceding mine yesterday, and she said that these were called, she was going to call these super plumes, and they were actually also called LLSVPs, which stands for large low shear wave velocity provinces. But she was going to use the term super plumes because that sounded more elegant. And she's a French lady who lives in Paris, so it's quite understandable that she would want to use an elegant term and not an ugly term. But nevertheless, I don't particularly like this term because it implies that these things are hot and that they're rising. And the evidence is that they probably, so here's the hot rising theory for the so-called super plumes. But analysis has shown that instead of being hot, they in fact have got low wave speed, but they've got high density. So some people have called them super piles because they're sort of dense bodies and they're thought to be sitting there on the core and they're not rising at all. So nobody really understands what they are, but it's expected that they owe their high density to a high amount of iron in olivine, compositionally anomalous. However, there's still a lot of people out there who prefer to interpret them as hot bodies. So let's call it a day there and have a 10-minute break. My clock says 5 minutes to two. So 5 minutes past, let's start the practical. And let me see now. We're going to do the focal mechanism today, aren't we? So I'll have to pop up and get materials for you.